Tarry here, where the stories never grow old, and you hear something new every time they are told and it comes clear. So tarry here, where it doesn't matter your age, and when we gather round the table, we all take the stage year after year. So tarry here.
Welcome to the Enlightened Radio Storytelling Hour at enlightenradio.org. I am your co-host, Fanny Crawford.
And I am the other co-host, Stasio Kowski.
We're broadcasting from Martinsburg, West Virginia, Bolivar, West Virginia, and Hagerstown, Maryland. And today is Monday, the 10th of April. And it's also, I knew it was the 10th. I couldn't remember what month it was.
Oh, it's okay.
But let me tell you that April 10th is also ASPCA Day, the American Society for the Prevention of Cruelty to Animals, Encourage a Young Writer Day, National Be Kind to Lawyers Day. Who invented that? National Cinnamon Crescent Day.
You know, people who name these days have to get a life.
I love them. I want to meet one of them. It's also Equal Pay Day. I think this is the day that women can start counting where their paychecks are going to be equitable. They have to work this many days. Never mind.
Yeah, that's one of those imaginary days, right?
Yeah, that's right. It's also Free Ice Cream Cone Day at Ben and Jerry's, if that's one of your hangouts, but only from 12 p.m. to 8 p.m. It's Golfers Day, International Safety Pin Day, National Farm Animals Day, National Library Day, National Library Workers Day, National Sibling Day, for those of us that have them, National Youth HIV and AIDS Awareness Day, and Salvation Army Founders Day. Doesn't that just blow your mind? And in addition to that, wait. It's April is among 100 others things. Drop Everything and Read Month. And that's abbreviated D-E-A-R. It's Deer Month. Drop Everything and Read. It's Defeat Diabetes Month. It's Emotional Overeating Awareness Month. It's National Poetry Month, National Garden Month, National Garlic Month, and National Humor Month. And that's all I'm going to say about that.
Well, I am reading a series of four books written by Arthur C. Clarke. And in those books, the time on Earth, the calendar on Earth doesn't count, which is wonderful. They don't have all those kind of big days. Oh yeah, this is a challenge for me. I picked up a book, got it through the library, reminded me of how much I like Arthur C. Clarke, and I'm reading. It's a four book series, and it is incredible. First book was almost 300 pages. Second was 500 pages. Third was 517 pages. And the fourth is over 600 pages. And I am into the fourth already. I just started this about 9 days ago.
See, that's only because you're obsessed with math.
No. It's Arthur C. Clarke. Okay. No, really. But, oh, yeah, the math thing came in because I was glad that they don't. You know, if you're in space, you don't use Earth time.
No, I was speaking about the number of pages.
Oh, well, yeah, that's it. Number of pages. It's like, shall I tell you about Speak?
Yes, I was just going to start waving my hands in the air.
Well, good.
You were patient with my April calendar.
I thought it was interesting. And I do feel feel like there are people who just have to do something to get their name on the bottom of a page. And, you know, and they say, oh, save the Anaconda Day. That's what I'm going to be doing, you know.
Okay.
So weird. Okay. Anyhow, we've already spent over 4.5 minutes. In yes. February, we had Priscilla Howell at Stories in a Realm. In
no,
March, we
now at Speak.
At Speak. You're right. I got mixed up because I'm so excited about Stories in a Realm coming in 2 weeks. Priscilla Howell was here, and Connie Reagan Blake was here in March. And now, this week, on Tuesday and Wednesday, Carmen Agradidi. And everybody's looking forward to that, I'm sure.
Wahoo!
And for some reason, you are very excited about seeing Carmen. I'm not sure why, but
she's a hoot. She makes me laugh.
Yeah. Right. Don't I make you laugh?
You're a hoot, too. I know a lot of hoots. Okay.
I know. Yeah, I realized today that we are co-hosts. Right? So here's another hoot for you. Anyway, Carmen Agradidi, April 11th, Tuesday, at the Frank Center, and April 12th at the Frank Center, both at 7:30 p.m. And Carmen will be going to Mogensville School in Hagerstown on Wednesday.
Oh, to, wow. Okay.
To perform for children.
My stomping yeah. grounds. Okay.
Really? I never heard of that school before. I did hear of Moggins Avenue or Moggins mm-hmm. Road or something because I got lost there once.
It it's is
another
easy
thing
to
I'm
get,
really
yeah.
good at.
It's easy so, to get lost in Moggins. So.
SpeakStoryseries.com. You could get all the information you could ever want to know or hear or need. And you could also get a pass for the whole season. So are you going to say anything about Stories in the Round?
Well, I will later on, but right now I just want to say thank you to Andy Offit-Irwin for opening the show for us as he does every single week. What a great guy to do that.
He's indefatigable.
It's nice.
Yes. And he is a wonderful performer and a good friend.
And he will be part of what I talk about when I get to Stories in the Round later on in the show. But would you like to start with a story? Do you have
I have a long story and I will do my best to cut it.
Well,
okay.
We could put you in the middle and I could tell a story at the beginning and one at the end.
Okay, why don't you do that?
Okay. Our theme today is water. We already told our listeners that. Nibe gizage igo kimeko etxuene nigo gizawene nigo. Water, we love you. Water, we thank you. Water, we honor you. There is a place not too far from here on the state line between Maryland and West Virginia. In West Virginia, it's called Canaan Valley. It's a beautiful place of old forests, very old trees, tall, tall trees, rivers and other waterways, and an abundance of waterfalls. Water that streams down steep cliffs and big roaring sheets. Two storytellers told me this story and taught me that song that I just sang for you in Canaan Valley. Those storytellers are Eileen, who lives in Canaan Valley, and Vanessa, who is a Native American artist and storyteller. Eileen and Vanessa showed us photographs and videos of people who participated in a 1,200-mile hike, a spirit walk along the Mississippi River, one of the longest rivers in the United States. And the walkers were grandmothers, Native American women from different Indian nations, the organizers and leaders from the Great Lakes region of the U.S. and Canada. Those lakes as big as some seas, Lake Erie, Lake Ontario, Lake Michigan, Lake Huron, Lake Superior. Nearby are many smaller lakes, including Lake Itasca, which is where this story begins. In many traditional Native American cultures, it is women who carry the water home from wells or springs. It's their responsibility to protect water, to make people aware of danger or crisis related to water. If the people's water is polluted or disappearing from drought or from overuse, it's their sacred duty to pay attention and warn the people. To do otherwise is to fail a sacred trust with Mother Earth, with the community, and with their own great, great, great grandchildren who may follow in the future. Water ceremonies used to be annual events for Anishinaabe speakers, the Chippewa, Ojibwe Nation, as recently as the late 1800s. Like many sacred traditions, they were forgotten amid pressures of modern conflicts and daily life. The grandmothers had many other things to worry about. This generation of grandmothers began their spirit walk in early March 2013 at Lake Itasca in northern Minnesota, near the Canadian border. It was cold. They were carrying a copper vessel, walking through snowstorms and a lot of rain. Lake Itasca was frozen that first day, but they filled the big copper pot with the very cold water from the part of the lake called the mouth, the headwaters of the Mississippi River. The Mississippi is the biggest river system in the United States and the third biggest in the world. The grandmothers carried this pure, clean water from the headwaters more than 1,200 miles to the Gulf of Mexico, where they poured it into the much stressed waters of the Gulf for the final stage of its journey to the sea. This was a spirit walk. The walkers said they were bringing a message of hope to the polluted waters at the end of the Mississippi River at the Gulf of Mexico, a hope for a better future and a memory of its pure and clean origins. The Anishinaabe women say the water they carried was orphaned, abandoned by humans, and they are carrying it and talking with it, carrying it to join the other waters. They talked about the copper bucket of water as if it were their child. And when they camped each night of the spirit walk by the side of the road, they sat at the fire, holding the pot in their laps as if it was a child. The first Mother Earth water walkers that I know about were two Anishinaabe Chippewa Ojibwe grandmothers who walked around Lake Superior in 2003, almost 20 years ago. Doreen Day, who wrote the Nibiwabo song that I sang at the beginning of this story, and Josephine Mandamin. Since then, Native American grandmothers have walked each year around all of the Great Lakes, from the Gulf of Mexico northward along the Mississippi, from Hudson Bay, and along the Pacific and Atlantic Oceans on our coasts. The walkers say water needs us. It is a living entity that must be cared for as it cares for us. On the journey to the Gulf in 2013, they spoke of Minnesota, the land of 10,000 lakes where aquifers are drying up, underground lakes now overused that will never be replenished. The water walkers speak of the support and interest from the people they meet as they walk. When they came to the edge of Minnesota and walked into Iowa, people on horseback met them and walked with them through their state. They speak of the group of tough-talking, all-male, all-white construction workers who accosted them, asking threatening questions. Hey, you women, where are you going with those pots and pans? This is not reservation land. Tell us who you are, where you're going. The grandmothers answered their questions, talking about the aquifers drying up, the dirty water in the Great Lakes and the Gulf of Mexico, and how they hoped their walking would help people understand how important it is to care for water. The men listened to the women and then went through their own pockets to collect $25 in change to give to the walkers to pay for their meals the next day of their journey. The men said, "Walk slow, pray hard, because our water too is contaminated." A grandmother from Blackwater Falls, Wisconsin, gave the walkers crocheted blankets, saying, "Just as every step of a water carrier is a prayer for water, every stitch of these blankets is a prayer for me. My well water was just ruled unsafe to drink." After telling us these stories, Eileen and Vanessa drove us to a local headwaters close by to where we met. The headwaters of the North Fork of the Potomac River. There's a marking stone there called Fairfax Rock, after Lord Fairfax, who had a map of the Potomac River made in 1763 and a stone placed to mark the headwaters. We visited the water there. We sang some Anishinaabe Ojibwe chants that Eileen had learned from the water walkers. That was the first time I had ever been to the headwaters of any river. Right by the house where Eileen lives, she took us to a meadow, open grassland at the West Virginia state line, across from Oakland, Maryland. The Potomac River is just a little stream there. This is just walking distance from the headwaters. And we sang again and collected water at these places. Now I collect water from the many places I visit and use in a little ceremony when I tell the story of the water walkers. So far, I've used water collected in California from the Pacific and the Chesapeake Bay near the Atlantic Ocean, mountains in Vermont, tap water from spigots in New York City and Chicago, and the Schuylkill River in Philadelphia. My dad grew up in Olean, New York, and played along Cattaraugus Creek there as a child. We planted a tree for him near the creek a few years ago, and friends and relations brought little bottles of water from their homes all over the United States and poured it over the roots of the sycamore tree we planted for him. I'm going to teach you that song that Eileen and Vanessa taught me. It's very short. We'll sing it twice. When I sing it in concert, I sing it seven times for the seven directions recognized by many Native American cultures: east, south, west, north, up, down, and inside each of us, because each of our bodies is almost 60% water. Doreen Day, who wrote this song, is happy that people are singing her song. She wants us to sing it, but she says, learn it from another human being. You can find it online, but first, learn it from a human. Next time you need a drink, I hope it will be water, and that you make choices that help you think about where that water came from, where it's going, and share this water with someone you love. Nibe gizage iko gime gwechwe ne ko gijawe ne ko Nibe gizage iko gime gwechwe ne ko gijawe ne ko. Water, we love you. Water, we thank you. Water, we honor you.
And is that it?
That's it.
Cool.
Did I lie about the time? Or was that true?
No. Do you have those words written down someplace?
I do.
That'd be nice to see.
Okay, I will send it to you.
Okay, thank you. All right, so here we go. I'm guessing I'm up.
You are.
All right. Well, just recently, I got my I've been a friend of the Smithsonian for off and on for a number of years. Sometimes they've printed stuff in their Smithsonian magazine and it irritated me, so I didn't join up the next year. But lately I've been reading some really interesting articles. And this was perfect. Last week, when we talked about what we're going to do, I happened to have this magazine sitting right next to me. And so this is a story about men and water and a river called the River of Doubt. Okay, so here we go. There are two main characters, more than two in the story, but two main characters that I think need to be mentioned at the beginning. First of all, a 48-year-old Brazilian Army colonel named Candido Mariano da Silva Rondon. Wow, I got through that pretty good. And by any measure, by a number of expeditions, distance traveled, degree of difficulty, information gathered, Rondon is the greatest explorer of the tropics in recorded history. He has a list of accomplishments that eclipses those of better known figures such as Stanley or Richard Francis Burton. All told, he participated in more than a dozen expeditions through Brazil's northern wilderness, surveying the country's hitherto unknown territory, mapping the borders, building roads and bridges, founding settlements, and making the initial peaceful contact with dozens of indigenous groups. Okay. So along comes Theodore Roosevelt. And he, you know, Roosevelt had just, he was being restless at the time for an adventure. And he had just finished an unsuccessful bid for the 1912 presidential term, which would have been his third. At that time in the United States of America, there was no restriction on how many times you could become the president like it is now. You can only have two terms now. So unless the crazies decide to change our Constitution and do all the other kind of destructive things they're doing right now. Okay, so Roosevelt had contacted the Brazilian authorities and they had referred him to Rondon. And Rondon had communicated with him and offered him five possible adventures or things. But no one knew how long the river was, nor the kind of terrain through which it flowed. Rondon had discovered the River of Doubt in 1909, and there was no mapping of it. No one knew how long it was and any details about which way it flowed and where it turned and all this stuff. So Roosevelt chose the adventure to go to the River of Doubt. Okay. Now, Roosevelt was admonished by friends at home that this would be very challenging. He was not a young man. He was in his 50s, but he was strong and he liked adventure. He had built a reputation of all kinds of adventures. However, one of the things that Rondon had told him was, there will be no shooting of game other than for food, and there will be no violence towards indigenous people. Rondon was a great believer in the exploration of difficult places. However, he insisted that there should be no violence on his expeditions of any kind. Albert Einstein actually nominated Rondon for the Nobel Peace Prize because of his work of discovery an investigation, and also because of the way he treated people. So the river descent itself, starting from the very first place that Rondon had discovered the river in 1909, it began on Friday, February 27th, 1914, following a grueling 2.5-month trek through the Pantanal, Brazil's vast inland swamp, and across the Mato Grosso Plateau. Breakfast was jerky hardtack and coffee. Then the last supplies were loaded onto their modes of transportation, which were canoes. Interesting kind of canoes, not the fancy ones that we have now. These were the ones made out of trees and kind of dug, they're considered dugout canoes, I guess. So some of the people on this thing, on this expedition, besides Colonel Rondon and Teddy Roosevelt himself, was Kermit Roosevelt, Teddy Roosevelt's 24-year-old son, who was a graduate of Harvard and had been working in Brazil doing some work on building bridges and engineering work. Kermit was not that thrilled about going on this expedition. However, his mother had urged him to go with Teddy so that he could help his father out, because his father was slowing down. Okay, so along with them, there were two of the guides were Jowell and Simplicio, and the doctor in the expedition was Dr. Calcaterra. And there was also an American naturalist by the name of George Cherry. Okay, so the beginning of the trip started out kind of nice. Things were working pretty smoothly, but because Rondon had insisted that this would be a science expedition and not just, you know, looking around and having fun, they were mapping the river. And it turned out that they discovered that the river overall, there lots of things happened during this expedition, but overall they discovered that the river made many turns, and at some points the river flowed in every one of the cardinal directions, north, south, east, and west, in many turns and things. What they found was some really difficult problems with the river. The first big challenge, on the afternoon of March 2nd, the river suddenly accelerated, and they found themselves bouncing through rapids with water foaming angrily ahead. The paddlers quickly pulled off to the right bank, secured the canoes, and set up camp. While scouting, the party hacked their way through the brush to reconnoiter. It turned out that during the time that they were on this river, scouting it, mapping it, they ran into many great problems. I imagine possibly they thought this might be relatively difficult, but not so challenging. What they discovered gave everyone pause. For half a mile, the river bounded downward through a series of boiling rapids, and they were broken by a pair of waterfalls 6 feet high. Now, the canoes they had were not made to go over waterfalls and land safely. So it narrowed dramatically through those rapids through a jagged sandstone gorge. It seemed extraordinary, impossible, Roosevelt wrote, that so broad a river could in so short a space contract its dimensions to the width of a strangled channel through which it now poured in its entire volume. So they came upon this narrow place. They had to carry the canoes past those little six-foot waterfalls. they weren't too surprised at that. But then they got to a place where they could not use the canoes to get downriver because they were in this gorge. And so what they did was, and right up at the edge of the basic flow of the river was the jungle. So what they did was, one of the members of the group by the name of Lyra, L-Y-R-A, and a party of camaradas, which were comrades, headed into the forest with axes and machetes. And the camaradas, there were 16 of those men who impressed Roosevelt so much and any other non-native Brazilians, because many of them didn't wear shoes, most of the time didn't wear a shirt, and they didn't complain, worked hard all day long, smiled, were friendly, and admired their work ethic and how dedicated they were to following what they were supposed to be doing. So some of these men went into the forest, hacked down trees. When they found certain kind of trees that would float, they were very buoyant. And some of them, they cut down into logs and put them across the, made a path among the tree, through the trees, put them side across the road, much like the, I guess, the corduroy roads that are were used in different places in history. And in America, there are a number of places where the corduroy roads are were very instrumental in being able to pass. And this way, they could take the canoes, sit them on top of the logs that were across the path, and they could drag them. It wasn't easy. In fact, it was very difficult, very hard work. And each time they had to do this, they struggled. There were times in their trip down the river that they lost canoes because of the water flowing so fast. And once they got off of the road that they made with the logs and put it the canoes back into the water, sometimes they lost control of them and wound up losing them. They had lots and lots and lots. They had 25 men in this expedition at this point. There were, they had lots and lots of supplies. However, every time they had a problem with one of the canoes sinking or overturning, something like that, it was just devastating to them because they would lose so much of their equipment and of the food. So at one point, Kermit Roosevelt was in the lead, one of the lead canoes, and Rondon had said that when they got up to this one certain part that he should pull to the right and follow the other canoe. But Kermit and his boatmen progressed barely a dozen yards when their canoe was, this is a quote, was sucked into a powerful downdraft. And I think that was probably what they meant by that description, was a sort of whirlpool, which spun the craft around. The canoe reached the end of the rapids upright, only to be seized by another whirlpool, which hurled it back into the midstream, overturning it. Now, all three men, tossed into the foaming water, were battling for their lives. Jowl grabbed for the tow line and swam for shore, but could not maintain his hold on the roof. Kermit managed to climb onto the keel of the overturned canoe and ride it like a bull at a rodeo through a second set of rapids before being thrown off. Desperate and exhausted, his waterlogged clothing weighing him down, he swam for shore, where he could only cling to a branch until he had recovered. Kermit was back on land, walking to find the others, when Rondon and Lyra encountered him on a trail. And Rondon said to him, possibly in a very sarcastic voice, the how did you enjoy your ride, since he had ignored Rondon's directions. And Rondon was in charge of the expedition. Anyway, Zhao showed up not long after that. He had swum back across the river, but there was no sign of Simplicio. In addition, the canoe was lost, along with the supplies. Devastated, Kerman set out on his own to search for Simplicio. He walked several miles, but recovered only one paddle and some single food tins. Simplicio's body was never found. In his diary, Kermit was guarded about his boatman's death, writing only Simplicio was drowned. For his part, Roosevelt portrayed the disaster as simply an accident of fate. In private conversation with Rondon, though, Zhao said that Kermit had heard his command to stop, but decided to see if he could run the rapids. So with no body to bury, Rondon had the men erect a memorial cross, reading, "Here perished the unfortunate Simplicio," at the edge of the rapids. He also named the falls in Simplicio's honor, and they appear as such on Brazilian maps even today. It's incredible. Another exhausting portage began in amid sheets of rain. The men were soaked. Rondon and his favorite dog, Lobo, headed down a jungle pass to do reconnaissance and with any luck shoot a game bird or a monkey for meat. But half a mile from camp, a peculiar howling echoed through the forest, almost but not exactly like that of a spider monkey, the largest simian in the jungle, and an excellent source of food. Lobo instinctively, Lobo's the dog, instinctively bounded ahead as Rondon peered into the canopy, his rifle at the ready. Within seconds, though, he heard his dog yelping, first in surprise and then in pain. He advanced cautiously, registering unwelcome human sounds, about short exclamations, energetic and repeated, and with a certain cadence. He had heard that before, but only when the indigenous war parties were ready to commence attack. He fired a single warning shot in the air, overcoming his initial impulse to run and defend Lobo, then hurried back to camp. Rondon's immediate concern was an ambush. He dispatched Mr. Cherry to warn the camaradas upstream, asked Roosevelt to mount guard at the end of the portage, and with Kermit, Lyra, and the indigenous scout Antonio Parisi accompanying him, returned to the trail in search of Lobo. When they reached the dog, he was already dead, pierced by a pair of poison-tinged arrows. It was unfamiliar to Rondon and Parisi. Before returning to the site of the ambush, Rondon had grabbed several axe heads and stuffed his pockets with colored beads, presents for what he assumed was a hunting party. He buried the dog next to a basket full of animal entrails that the Indians had brought as bait, but abandoned as they fled. Around the Lobo's grave, Rondon arrayed his gifts to signal to the indigenous group, likely members of the people known as the Cinta Larga, whose relations with the outside world continue to be tense, even violent into the 21st century. And he did this to signal that his intentions remained peaceful. Next, there are a number of things coming up that are so exciting. The men navigated two sets of rapids using the end around way of getting into the jungle at the edge and hauling their canoes along the path. Really? The River of Doubt itself did not flow west from there, but rather likely flowed northward for hundreds of miles, eventually disgorging into the Madeira River, the Amazon's largest tributary. So the Cinta Larga, those indigenous people, no longer bothered to keep their surveillance secret and waged an unrelenting campaign of intimidation. They were concealed in the jungle and they were very close, for the dogs were constantly barking at some unseen presence. Yeah, right. as they continued on their journey, the health problems were beginning to emerge among the overtaxed boatmen. Crossing enemy territory, tormented by mosquitoes and ants. The camaradas who didn't want to wear shoes and their feet were now so swollen that they could barely carry on. Cajazeera tried to relieve everyone's suffering and maintain in good condition the health of everyone on the expedition. He was the doctor. But there were already two cases of fever. The journey ahead is undoubtedly a very long one, Cherry wrote in his diary. He concluded the entry on a fatalistic note. It is very doubtful if all of our party ever reaches the Manaus, Manawa. Manaus is was the end of the river and a place that Roosevelt was interested in getting to because once he got to that point, his part of the adventure would be done. And okay, so Rondon agreed to abandon fixed position method of mapping, which was very tiring. Sometimes they would stop 100 times a day, even though they hadn't moved very far, to put up a thin pole with a red flag on it so that they could do some surveying and they could map how the river turned, how much of a turn it was, and could keep a record of it. It had slowed down so much that they finally abandoned that method and did it in a different way, which didn't take as much time. They'd been on the river exactly a month when maneuvering a pair of dugout canoes through a set of narrow rapids, several camaradas lost their hold on the boats, which rammed into rocks and began to sink. Responding to shouts for help, Roosevelt jumped into the water and chest deep in the turbulent stream, joined the men in straining and lifting to their utmost. He gashed a shin badly on a jagged rock. Blood began to spurt from the wound. At camp, Roosevelt tried to play down the severity of the injury, which he attributed to his own clumsiness. The doctor dressed the wound with antiseptic and wrapped it in gauze. Roosevelt stayed off his feet for 2 days, but then walking downriver to the next campsite, he was forced to pause repeatedly because of the pain. Upon arriving at the next campsite, Roosevelt lay flat down on the damp earth for some time before recovering. Not only did Roosevelt's wound become infected, but soon it was clear he was also suffering attacks of malaria. His temperature soared to 105 degrees. And he slipped into delirium. One night, just before dawn, Jerry heard Roosevelt call his name, and he rushed to his side. Kermit was already there. "Boys, I really realize that some of us are not going to finish this journey," Roosevelt said. "I want you and Kermit to go on. You can get out. I will stop here." His deteriorating health was disheartening. Early on March 28th, he and Kermit, accompanied by Lyra and Luez Carolla, a paddler, set out on foot from their camp to reconnoiter a daunting canyon that lay ahead. When they returned, filthy, drenched in rain and sweat, bruised and drained of energy, the dazed and somber look on Rondon's face told the others that he had bad news. The canyon continued for almost 2 miles, and its flow of water was broken by a half dozen cataracts, one of which was more than 30 feet high. Rondon saw no way to navigate through that gauntlet in the canoes, but he also deemed it impossible to detour around the gorge with another portage. Worse, the canyon marked the start of rocky, hilly terrain that extended for miles. So Rondon proposed a desperate solution: abandon the canoes, reduce equipment yet again, hike to the end of the mountains, and build new canoes there. To all of this, his report was practically a sentence of death to all of the others. Kermit openly disagreed with Ron. He had acquired formidable skills while working as an engineer, and he and Lyra thought they could get some of the canoes through the canyon. Roosevelt supported his son, as did the doctor, and the camaradas, who worked closely with Kermit and grown to like him. It took nearly 4 days to get to the canoes through the canyon. Hard work, wet all day, half rations, was Kermit's laconic summary in his diary the second day. But they succeeded with only the smallest canoe sacrifice and with no loss of life. Almost immediately, though, after they made camp at dusk on April 2nd, Manuel Vincent de Paxio, a towering army corporal Rondon had placed in charge of the camaradas, caught a paddler named Julio de Lima stealing food from their ration tins. A really serious offense. The brawny corporal punched the thief in the face and warned him against raiding the provisions. The next morning, while the men hauled crates down to the canoes, another paddler caught de Lima secretly gobbling the last of a tin of beef jerky. Then Paxio noticed him straggling behind the others, carrying a much lighter load, and dressed him down again. They arrived at the staging point. Paxio laid down the carbine he carried before heading back to fetch another load. De Lima was not far behind him. Suddenly, the crack of a firearm echoed above the rapids. Roosevelt, rifle in hand, and the doctor, armed with a revolver, rushed up the trail. They found Paxio lying face down in his own blood. The doctor, kneeling to examine him, noted that the gunpowder residue indicated that De Lima had fired point blank, shooting Paxio through the heart. Now everyone was in danger. De Lima was still armed and hiding nearby. Rondon was in a blind rage to find him. Kermit wrote that the commander soon recovered his equilibrium and ordered his most capable scouts to try to pick up De Lima's trail and apprehend the criminal. Yeah. The scouts returned from their investigation and search for De Lima. But all they found was his carbine, which was on the ground. They had recovered from a tangle of vines where he had appeared to abandon it. This greatly reduced the risk that De Lima might attempt to kill anyone else, and it left the murderer defenseless. Turning to Roosevelt, Rondon remarked, "Now he will be punished by the force of the circumstances in which he has placed himself." Excuse me. On Easter Sunday that year, the explorers spent 8 hours hauling their equipment while the canoes ran the rapids. "Father is not well," Kermit wrote that night. "I am much worried." The next day, Roosevelt was so debilitated he had to travel flat on his back, shielded only by a piece of canvas and what remained of a broad-brimmed straw hat that the insects had mostly consumed. On April 15th, Rondon, who was in the lead canoe now, spotted a crude sign nailed to a tree along the riverbank and carved with the initials J.A. Before long, the explorers found a thatched hut in the middle of a planted clearing, guarded by three yelping dogs. Inside were sacks of canvas flour and rice, as well as an ample supply of yam. But the owner, a rubber tapper, was not there. And Rondon refused to allow his famished men to help themselves to the provisions. Instead, he left a note listing the names of all the surviving members of the expedition and where they had come from. Several miles downstream, the explorers encountered another person, an old man, who, assuming they were Indian war party, frantically began to paddle away. But was when Rondon stood up, waved his helmet, and called out to him in Portuguese, the rubber tapper allowed the four dugouts, filled with emaciated, feverish, bearded men in rags, to come alongside. The man had no food to share, but he told Rondon that they could obtain provisions from the other rubber tappers nearby. A few miles downstream, the explorers saw puffs of smoke coming from a hut. And a woman with a baby in her arms rushed outside, took one look at them, screamed, and ran off into the jungle. Rondon ordered the paddlers to stop and make camp. while waiting for the woman's return, presumably with her husband. Kermit and Sherry carried Roosevelt to the hut and laid him on a cot. The cook already had a fire going when the couple appeared with two neighbors armed with rifles. Once they realized their guests, who their guests were part of a government party, they were generous and helpful with food and information. That night, a camarada named Antonio Correa remarked to Kermit, "Seems like a dream to be in a house again and hear the voices of men and women instead of being among these mountains and rapids." The next morning, the doctor operated on Roosevelt's leg and without an anesthetic. The doctor sliced into the swollen tissue and watched it empty of pus. He then inserted the drainage tube into the incision. Roosevelt lay silent. Kermit and Cherry helped the weakened patient into the dugout. Following day, while Rondon and Lyra took advantage of a cloudless sky to plot the expedition's coordinates, Kermit visited local rubber tappers and came back with 5 pounds of rice. 6 hours downstream, they encountered a man Kermit called a certain Barbosa in a riverside manor house. The man not only gave us a duck and a chicken and some cassava and 6 pounds of rice and would take no payment. Roosevelt recorded that but he furnished them with new clothes. He also accepted a small canoe in exchange for use of a large flat-bottomed boat, big enough to erect a tent to protect Teddy Roosevelt from the elements. The infection spread throughout Roosevelt's body and he developed an abscess on his right buttock, so severe that he could not sit down. "He eats very little," Cherry wrote. "He is so thin that his clothes hang on him." The expedition was moving quickly now, and after a set of rapids, the explorers found the general store, the first they had seen in more than 3 months. The next day, the explorers began to encounter heavily laden batelos making their way upstream, carrying food and other supplies to remote settlements. The boat pilots all recognized Rondon. One after another, they passed on the good news. A welcome party was waiting for them at the junction of the Castano and the Arpuna rivers, only 4 days away. Weary and bedraggled men reached the confluence of these two majestic rivers on Sunday, April 26th. Behind them lay almost unimaginable trials and privations that resulted in the death of 3 of their group, prostrated many with illness and forced each to endure long periods of hunger. Ahead loomed worldwide acclaim for the feat they had accomplished, mapping the previously unknown tropical river of doubt over the course of its nearly 1,000 miles. Today, that river has been renamed. It was renamed then Roosevelt River. And if you look on the map of Brazil, you'll find that that is the way it's labeled. Less than a week later, Roosevelt lay recuperating in a bed at the governor's palace in Manaus. Kajera had spirited the former president from his quarters aboard the government steamship that had picked them up at the camp of a rubber baron and operated immediately, lancing Roosevelt's abscess and draining it. He also gave the former president heart medication and prescribed a strict regimen of quinine. Roosevelt sent a telegram to his wife announcing that he and Kermit had survived and another message to the Brazilian Foreign Ministry in Rio de Janeiro. "We have had a hard and somewhat dangerous but very successful trip," he wrote, before enumerating the expedition's perils and major achievements. And he wrote, "My dear sir, thank you from my heart for the chance to take part in this expedition." Before they left and returned to the United States, Roosevelt gave each of the surviving men from the expedition 2 gold sovereigns, and he also provided the same amount for the families of each of the men who were killed during this. So the River of Doubt is now called the Roosevelt River, and it is marked on the maps in Brazil, 1,000 miles long, and was one of Teddy Roosevelt's last adventures because he died at the age of 60, just 3 years later. This adventure was incredible to read about it and to tell about it. I probably told 15% of their horrible adventures. And anyway, it was exciting to read. And there were, even in the Smithsonian Magazine, there were pictures taken at that time of the men at the camp before they began down the river, and then during their travels down the river and moving the boats and things. I have actually helped to move a canoe when I was young around some rapids in a river that was probably a stream to what these guys had. And it wasn't fun carrying a canoe full of all kind of junk that we had, things that we would not have had with us had it been an expedition. We were just out for a day of fun. But we had carrying that canoe on land for a good half mile to get around those rapids was pretty exhausting. So anyway, I have some feeling of warmth and heroic bravery for those men who did this. And it is well known that Teddy Roosevelt loved doing all kinds of adventures. And he did lots of things, like started the national parks and in the country while he was president and afterwards. But he even thought about running in the 1920 election, but he wasn't able to because he was gone.
Wow, that's quite a story.
Isn't that amazing?
Yeah.
Yes. I kept picking it up, putting it down, and reading, because my legs were bothering me thinking about it. I have a trouble with my legs anyway, but that made me think, I'll sit in the canoe and you carry me.
I'm going to real quick talk about stories in the round. Grand opening is April 24th. That will be Susan Gordon, Monday the 24th at 7 p.m. In May, we have Black Storytellers of Western Maryland going to present an anthology of stories, poems, and writings of Maryland griots. And they're going to tell stories of their own. Lynn Distance, Patricia Smart, and grandmother Edna Lawrence Williams will be the tellers. And I hope people will come out for those two events. And then in June, Andy Offit Irwin will be with us. And that's the fourth Monday in June. All of these sessions so far are the fourth Monday in June. And our fourth Mondays. So Andy is the fourth Monday in June. And then the fourth Monday in July will be Jane Dorfman.
Whoa.
Calamity Jane. And if you have not heard this new story of Jane Dorfman as Calamity Jane, you need to hear this. Pretty amazing. So I'm excited, and we're working on contracts for the rest of the season, but that's what we have lined up so far. And I think we are out of time.
So, I think you're right.
For more information about Stories in the Round at the Unitarian Universalist Church of Hagerstown, you can call me, Fanny Crawford, at 301-730-1638. Or go to Fanitsky, Fanitsky, at hotmail.com. This is Fanny Crawford and
Stosh Ziolkowski
closing out the Enlightened Radio Storytelling Hour at enlightenedradio.org. We are independent community radio broadcasting from Bolivar, West Virginia, Morgantown, Martinsburg, West Virginia, and Hagerstown, Maryland.
Wow.
Offering our listeners a window into the world of telling by traditional and non-traditional tellers, encouraging our listening community to share, preserve, and expand all of our stories. Stay tuned.
Four. Very smooth jazz.